The Sunstone Foundation presents Mormon Women and Domestic Violence, The Patriarchal Connection, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus, where the program is about to begin.
In a personal experience I had last January, the bishop in my singles ward, without realizing he had a radical in his midst, asked me to give a talk in sacrament meeting, and he told me that I should pray and try to get inspiration for that talk. And so I did this, and actually was delighted to finally have some inspiration that I recognized and knew and didn't doubt. The bad news was that I felt compelled to talk about domestic violence in sacrament meeting. And it was clear to me that this was not commonly done, but it was also clear to me that I had some inspiration, which I was very grateful for. So I, understanding the consequence of speaking out on these issues and also of identifying myself as someone who had been involved in that, I sort of did it with a good deal of trepidation, and most of my best and worst expectations were fulfilled in that experience. And afterwards I found that it was very hard for people to talk to me, and that the people that had formerly been able to have reasonable conversations with me now could only talk about what kind of clothing I was wearing, and some people just couldn't talk to me anymore, and some people made really, I thought, very kind and generous efforts to talk to me when it was very hard for them. I could just see how having an experience like this sort of it is like being pregnant, in that it stands out there and everybody speaks to it. When you're pregnant, people talk to your stomach and feel it as sort of a public piece of property. And this piece of information, which I had revealed about myself, became like that to me. So it was difficult, but I kept going to the singles ward because I thought that they needed to factor people like me into the equation. But it made me realize how unspeakable this issue is, both in I think, the general world context and in this context of Mormonism, and that it needs, that's a problem. The more unspeakable it is, the more it is allowed to continue. So that was my personal impetus for organizing this panel. The concept of spouse abuse is probably less than 20 years old, and the concept of child abuse is only just a little bit older. The reason why that concept is so young is that we could only understand something like abusing a spouse when we quit believing that men had total legal, physical, and ownership rights over their families. So we had to sort of move to a certain place in, I think, our social values before there could be an idea like marital rape or spouse abuse or something like that. There are certain conditions in Mormonism that I think make the additional presence of domestic violence just disastrous. One is that I know, according to the census, Mormons, girls have about the youngest age at first marriage of almost any state, which means that as they're marrying very young, they're very likely to be unskilled and not have college degrees, which means when time comes to get out of that marriage, they have very few alternatives. We also have one of the highest fertility rates. So it means that when it comes time to make a change in your life, you've got twice as many children as everybody else and a whole lot less skills. So you're economically strapped to a situation that may be abusive. And this doesn't take into account any of the sort of socialization factors of how we're sort of taught to stay in anyway, but it certainly creates, I think, a serious combination of problems. We want to define what we mean by these terms a little bit to you. I don't know if we'll be using these terms, but when the word assault, the legal definition is it's the threat of violence or intimidation when the intimidator has the means of carrying out that threat. So when my children tell me they're going to kill me, that wouldn't be called assault because they don't likely have that. They can't likely carry that out. When my husband tells me that, it would be considered assault. He's bigger than me. He could do that. Battery, on the other hand, is the actual doing of that, carrying out of that threat. We're defining abuse, and I'm using, as you may tell, the words domestic violence and abuse sort of interchangeably, which I hope is not a problem for you. Violence, I'm using mostly to refer to physical violence, and abuse refers to verbal, physical, psychological harm on another person. We're not talking here about sexual abuse. Sexual abuse is another very serious problem. and it's important, it's a common form of abuse, but the dynamics of it, both the dynamics of the interactions and the dynamics of treating it, are very different, or at least significantly different from what we're discussing, so we're not going to talk about sexual abuse. You can see that with this broad definition that I'm offering, most marriages are going to qualify at some time with this definition. And I don't think that's a problem. I think the only problem is when you understand that you're in a situation like this or that you are harming somebody and you don't do something to correct that. Also, I think it's important to say that within this definition of abuse, there is often a fight in a relationship over who gets to define it. For instance, in my relationship with my husband, I was consistently troubled, consistently unhappy, consistently voicing this. I'm not a silent sort of person. And he was consistently saying, we're happily married. This is a happy situation. And I recently ran across a poem he wrote me for Mother's Day, probably 2 weeks before I moved west, about how happy we were. So what's going on there is a sort of a power struggle over who gets to define the relationship. And I want to argue to you that the recipient of the behavior gets to define what it is. If you think I'm being abusive to you, then you get to decide it. I try to work this out with my children. My son is always hurting the girls, and he says it doesn't hurt them, and I say they get to decide that. It's up to the recipient to decide that. I also want to sort of offer a little caveat. We're probably going to fall into the problematic stereotype of looking at men as the abusers and women as the abused. Clearly, it's a possibility for it to be the other way around, and that is a reality in a minority of cases. And so forgive me for doing that. We're really talking about that dynamic that has to do with women. It's sort of a different dynamic when men abuse women than when women abuse men, I think in large part because of the physical differences in size. I also want to just briefly mention two different views of violence that you will read in the newspapers and see. Feminists are probably the people that we have to thank for bringing this into sort of a speakable situation so that we can talk about violence. Feminists have always posited the abused as a victim, the abuser as sort of a criminal sort of person. You know, if we could lock them up, it would be better. They will stereotype by gender, as I just mentioned, and make clear the importance of the difference in physical strength between males and females on the results of violent behavior. They have identified major discrepancies in the distribution of physical, economic, psychological, and sociocultural power in relationships. So I think the feminist view has been very helpful in describing the problem, in making it sort of speakable and known, and in protecting victims. However, when it comes to treatment, this view doesn't take you very far, because we would argue that abuse is a relational situation. It's interactional. You can't be an abuser without an abused. We might want to fight about that, but anyway, this is sort of a systemic view that looks at a relationship as, you know, two people interacting in it as part of it. The abusers need the abused. Interactional patterns create the abusive cycle, but as long as a person stays in a relationship, then they are part of that abusive cycle and are sometimes saying in their very presence, it's okay for you to behave like this to me. I'm still here. So I would argue that both partners have a degree of complicity, though one of the really unfortunate things of this cycle is that the abused often take an inordinate amount of responsibility for the behavior of the abuser, and that is, of course, something that counselors try to help them work through quite a bit. Now, I want to move to my personal experience. I'm basically going to give you a laundry list divided into four categories: what it was like being in this kind of relationship, why I stayed in, how I got out, what I think the after effects were on me. First of all, since this is sort of nebulous, I want to give you just a couple examples of abuse. What I'm not going to talk about here, because it's embarrassing and I'm shy, and you don't want to hear it, is all the sexual part that was sort of part and parcel of all of this. But suffice it to say that within a month of me being married, I was pregnant, and all I remember is that it was sort of awful and that I was really tired all the time and working full time, and my husband was going to school. And I remember one night him bouncing up and down on my bed and reading from his gynecology textbook. He was in medical school. Reading from his gynecology textbook to keep me awake because I wouldn't have sex with him. And I remember sort of not having a category to put this experience into because nobody was hitting me. And I couldn't sleep, and I knew that sleep was really important to me. And I remember thinking, God, my brothers didn't used to treat me like this. I wonder if this is how marriage is supposed to be. And there were just a lot of incidents like that that never involved physical harm, but involved a lot of sort of intimidation that happened over the years. And after about 6 or 7 years, one time we had a situation, and these are always complex. We had a situation where my husband was up all night because he was working and was due home to help me to take care of my children because I was teaching piano students, and he forgot, which is sort of a passive-aggressive way of dealing with things you don't like to do. He forgot to come home, and then he forgot to come home, and of course I was able to teach and do my kids at the same time, but I wasn't real happy about it. And when he came home, I nagged him, and that was the one time when he physically beat me up, and he sort of banged me against the bed and bashed me and terrified the children and terrified me, and that was the time I had bruises that I really earned. So that's the kind of abuse that I'm describing in this relationship. But these are, of course, rare circumstances. That was the only time when I was my person was physically harmed. A lot of other times, or some other times, when I was thrown out of the house and things like that, but not where I was physically hurt. These are the characteristics, I think, that it was like. One was that it really changed my self-concept quite a bit. And I didn't realize this until I had a meeting with a group of friends, and we sort of named ourselves as in opposition to homemaking meeting, and we called ourselves Stitch and Bitch. And we met together and discussed things, and this night we were discussing self-esteem. And all of these women, we began to discuss if their self-esteem was better since they were married than afterwards. And all of these women talked about having had very low self-esteems before they were married and a lot higher afterwards. And I was the only one, and I realized that I had been sort of an adored person in my family until I got married. Well, I was still adored at that time, but that just wasn't the primary relationship anymore. And I began to realize that my self-esteem had significantly gone down. Part of that is because you're in a very intimate relationship with someone who's also trying to define your reality. And so my husband really needed to tell me all the time that I was complaining, which I was indeed complaining. But we began to have sort of a fight over. I had thought of myself as a happy, cheerful person, and I wasn't a happy, cheerful person in that relationship, so I began to rethink of myself as maybe somebody who was chronically unhappy and chronically complaining. And I respected my husband quite a bit, so I tended to believe his definitions. Also, at this time, I remember thinking I was crazy, that everybody else was happy, everybody told me I should have been happy, and maybe I was just exaggerating. Maybe I had too high of expectations for marriage. Another problem was that I had no experience in marriage, so you sort of tend to think maybe this is it. Maybe this is why people sort of whisper to you and say, marriage is really an adjustment. You know, maybe that was it. I also felt that maybe I was partially responsible for this violence, and so I needed to stay in there and help fix it. Another thing was we had a very beautiful family. It was a very nice gene pool. I have 4 beautiful children, and my father-in-law is a professional photographer, so even if we weren't beautiful, he managed to make us look beautiful. And people kept talking about us as this beautiful, perfect family. My husband's a doctor, and I was educated, and that was really a heavy burden for me. And I always felt that I shouldn't disappoint my family and the church and show that I wasn't this happy couple. And I always felt like I was sort of lying when I mailed out the Christmas pictures of our beautiful family. Another thing that happens, I think, and that happened to me is that I learned to recognize the oncoming signs. And oftentimes with these outbursts, it happens very quickly. But you learn, since it's a matter of survival, you learn to sort of see it coming. And we were once in family therapy, and I was complaining that my husband didn't give the children warning that he was going to get mad. And my little 5-year-old daughter at that time said, "Oh, he warns us. We know. He goes like this." And when she did this, a lot of stuff came out of her nose. But it was very clear that the children even knew that everybody had picked up those signs, and everybody knew they had 30 seconds from that breath to be out of there or to shape up. So you do learn to recognize that stuff. It's a matter of survival, and it's important. I came to feel that my family and the church cared more about the stability of my marriage than about me. And my family, who will hear this tape someday, I love them and they love me, but I think the idea of not getting divorced was really important, and my parents had stuck it out for a good amount of time and still are, so I think that that was really hard, and that it, they just sort of didn't hear it because it wasn't a possibility that we could break up. And even when they knew the story of the violence, they really suggest that we work on it and work it out and go into counseling and that kind of stuff, but you know, getting out of it was really radical. I think also part of the way I bought into that is that I spoke very euphemistically, that later when I went back and talked to some of my friends, I said, that isn't what you were saying. You were just complaining all the time. We didn't know that that's what was really going on. And I think that I was still sort of protecting my reputation, and so I was afraid to really say how it was, and also I wasn't really clear on how it was. So also that other people would sort of say that it's normal. You know, I'd say, is it always like this when you're having babies? Is it always like this when you're poor? Is it always like this when your husband never comes home? And, you know, it sort of is in some ways. So you don't really know if this is a normal unhappiness or not. So I felt that I didn't get heard, or that I was saying the wrong things or something. And, of course, in a situation like this, you feel sort of powerless and vulnerable. Like, what this other person does has everything to do with the outcome of your life. I think in many ways my husband felt the same, that I had a lot of power over his life, too. Now, why I stayed in. These are sort of classical things. I stayed in because I didn't trust my own judgment. I was always asking other people's stories to see if their marriages were worse than mine, to finally figure out if it would be okay for me to get divorced. I also believed and was taught to believe that divorce would ruin my children. I had economic fears. I had these visions of me teaching kindergarten for the rest of my life, which actually is a whole lot better than some people's situation, but I didn't relish it. And and at the time when things got very bad, I was pregnant with my fourth child, so I had this visualization of, you know, trying to do it with all these babies, and that was very scary to me. Also, I believed in eternal marriage and eternal families, and so I didn't really want to give up that belief. I think that was one of the strongest influence, is how much I wanted that to be true. Also, I didn't have any training to recognize abuse. You just don't know. Nobody ever tells you about when to quit. They talk to you about eternity, which seemed long. But nobody tells you, okay, this is bad enough, now you should quit. And I didn't see myself as a quitter. And I always still thought maybe I could, and maybe it was my responsibility to fix it. You know, maybe if I just read one more book, or if we just got a new counselor, or if I just analyzed a little bit more, if my husband would just listen and he could understand and that kind of stuff. And then there are all the sort of social and family pressures that people feel. You know, you become a child again as a divorced person, and I didn't know how I'd fit in the church and all of those kind of things. The next short section is on how it was that I got out. And I guess I would say that the strongest influence to me was feminism, and that I went back to graduate school. And so besides my church friends, who I was being sort of euphemistic around, I had these graduate student friends who sort of called a spade a spade. In fact, they might call it something a whole lot worse than that. And I would talk to them, and they would always say, they would be very straight and say, that's sick. I can't believe it. And that was like another view of reality. And so I would always sort of go back and forth between these two views, and I didn't know what I thought. And that other view began to hold some weight with me. And of course, I wanted it to. I mean, that's partly it, that I liked it a lot better than the church one, because it meant that there was some hope for my situation. And what was generally being offered from the other view was, you just need to tolerate it more. No one said it would be easy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And feminism helped me to understand my personal history in sort of a larger form, and I thought that was very useful. I could see that what was happening to me was not half as bad as was happening to a lot of people. Also, when I went into court to get a restraining order and saw the other women that were there, I began to get the picture that I was lucky. I saw that there was a political and economic function to the oppression of women, so I sort of got how this all worked and why it was important for me to stay in the marriage, you know, who was going to benefit from that. I understood that the notion of the privacy of the family perpetuated the possibility of making spouse abuse unspeakable. That the fact that we think of families as private and that we shouldn't interfere means that abuse can continue and that we don't have to talk about it. And that notion has some good sides and some bad sides, but I began to see where it was taking me. And I also saw that we have things in our culture that support violence, that make it possible, that made it possible for my husband to do that to me and not to feel very bad about it. And I began to get educated. And as I began to get educated, I began to see other alternatives. Both I was preparing myself economically, but also personally. You know, I began to see that people do get out and you can do these other things. And I began to read the literature on divorce and children and saw that divorce is not bad for kids at all. It's stress and tension that are bad for children, men, women, everybody. And I began to realize that the stress of knowing that their mother and father might be screaming any minute was probably worse than the stress of me struggling financially all the time trying to do too much. And I realized also at some point that the church's support for my marriage was ideological and not material, that in the end I wasn't going to get any money or any help to stay in that situation. I was just going to feel a certain amount of pressure to do it. And probably the most important reason, which was never counted as a reason by the people I talked to, was that I knew myself to be a generous, optimistic, trusting person. I knew that that was true in my soul, and I knew I was killing it. I knew that I was getting to be caustic and sarcastic and cynical, and I felt that that was a sin against the Holy Ghost, and that it wasn't right for me to turn out like that. And I thought, I need to get out before I don't believe in anybody anymore. So, the after effects were interesting, and it's interesting that there is, I think, a lot that goes on afterwards. One was, what I did to get out is that I moved my children and moved to Utah from Rhode Island and just started coming to graduate school. So I didn't get divorced. We just sort of did a trial separation. And I was lucky that I was able to do it like that. And I remember walking across campus that first fall, and they have these beautiful flower beds here. And I remember just sort of thinking, how did I get so lucky? I'm free, and I have my children, and I get to learn things, and feeling that, you know, opportunities had opened up to me. And I remember also, I went into counseling at that time, and it was interesting to me that when I was finally out of this scary situation, that I had all of a sudden a clear vision, and I could look back and see all of these incidences of intimidation and abuse as a pattern. I had never thought of that before. I had always thought of them as individual arguments. We solved that. That one will never happen again. Okay, we put out this brush fire. That will never happen again. And then I saw that all along it had been a battle over the definition of the relationship and over control. And there's a fight over who should control me. And I never saw that while I was inside of it. I could only see it when I got out. Another thing that happened was, and Linda Sillitoe sort of explained this to me, I didn't know why this was true, but also as I was walking across campus looking at the flower beds, I was noticing the men that were physically big and strong and thinking that, and, you know, like I would grab my keys or make sure I wouldn't be in a dark corner and feeling vulnerable, like these men could hurt me. And Linda mentioned to me that probably what was going on there is that when you're sort of under fire, you suppress or sort of freeze these fears because it's sort of a constant thing to be afraid. And I think it was when I got out and it was actually safer that I began to be afraid. And that was sort of sad because people had always said about me that I was fearless. And so now I'm not. But I'm not afraid of powerful men anymore. But I also don't get in dark corners with them. Another thing that just sort of came up then was just this constant economic pressures, you know, just constantly doing too much, constantly worrying about money. And I think a fear that I have and will carry with me always is that I will never be economically dependent on anybody again. I just would never consider that a safe situation for me. And the other after effects, I guess, are sort of the stigma of, you know, there's certainly a stigma to divorce, but it's not as bad as it was. But there's a significant stigma when I tell people that, I was in a relationship like this, because we still have a tendency to blame the victim. And still people will ask me questions that are sort of trying to get at how it was I caused it. And I think that's an interesting question, but it's not particularly helpful to a victim, probably. So that's the end of my laundry list.
I decided that given considerations of legal considerations and also considerations of time and emotion, that probably the best thing for me to do was to write what I have to say and to read it. I'll try to do that without it being too dry. But looking out at you, I see a lot of familiar faces, and it occurred to me that maybe I should say, first of all, that for those of you who know me, you shouldn't judge my family by me. if you do, you're not going to understand the story I'm about to tell you. I'm the second of eight children in a very Orthodox Mormon family, and I'm the only person with spotted character in terms of being a feminist or heretic. And I do have one sister who's interested in Sunstone and Dialogue, but no other members of my family have ever attended or participated in this kind of thing. So I think you need to understand that at the outset. As Anne mentioned, as a newspaper writer on social issues, I learned about spouse abuse, writing about domestic violence and child abuse, writing about mental health and mental illness, and writing about homicide. And I learned in the early 80s that most people in Utah who are murdered are killed by someone they know and love. More importantly, a little more than a year ago, during a long conversation that I don't think I'll ever forget, I learned that one of my sisters, Janine, was in a very difficult and potentially dangerous marriage. That conversation began my education in a wholly different way, as I committed myself to being her advocate and what has become a long and sometimes frightening and sometimes illuminating journey. So I'm here to discuss the role of, quote, rescuer, the family member, friend, or neighbor who tries to help. And just as abuse within families is common, the role of would-be rescuer is common too, and it's very difficult. Although I'm drawing from a personal experience, I suspect that it's adaptable to many different situations and that many of you will find it familiar in some ways. I'm going to try to keep my comments as pragmatic as I can, but I found that in order to be concrete, I do need to be somewhat specific personally. Let me say first that this term rescue, I think I use partly because my sister's situation required just that. Physical flight, medical intervention, and legal enforcement. However, resolution is a fine substitute for the word rescue if the solution can be found within the marriage. In fact, resolution is what Janine and I discussed between July of last year and Good Friday of this year when we moved her and her babies to an apartment and she obtained a protective order and began divorce proceedings. Before that, Janine had tried many types of rescue or resolution. In addition to continually struggling to keep the peace, she tried counseling, a community abuse program, calling the police, an in-hospital program for her husband, as well as talks with her bishop and other church leaders. Had any of these methods provided a resolution, she would have viewed the counselor, police officer, bishop, or doctor who helped them as a rescuer. Rescue needs to be defined in another way also. Through our family's experience, I realized why many women in abusive situations never manage to extricate themselves, despite the emotional and physical damage that they and or their children suffer. Janine's support system ultimately included not only the community resources that I mentioned, but also the emotional, strategic, or financial support of our parents and her seven brothers and sisters, five of their spouses, plus a few of their friends. Every bit of it was needed, and many women simply don't have that kind of support. Essentially, however, rescue must come from within, not only from without. The bonds that hold us most tightly are within us, not imposed upon us, and they are the hardest to loosen. Marital problems are notoriously frustrating for police officers, counselors, friends, families, and others because of the ambivalent feelings of the person who is being rescued. Until she is free internally, external rescue can only be temporary. And when a wife returns to the abusive husband, her support system often collapses in dismay and frustration, and often the danger to her increases. Marriage, after all, is a complex bond woven of many experiences and emotions. In virtually all marriages in Western civilization, marriage involves choice and usually love. In addition, whatever vulnerability, insecurity, or recklessness initiated the union still exists, probably unconsciously, within the abused person, and likely it has been reinforced by the abuse. My first and cardinal rule was that I would not tell Janine what she should do. Not only did she have to make that decision and live with it, but I knew that if I voiced an opinion, I would be discredited when her inner pendulum swung the other way, which happened about every other conversation. My role, I decided, was to work on her self-esteem, which was below ground level, so that she could become empowered instead of helpless. The problem was that as her self-esteem gradually rose, the tensions at home rose too, and her situation became increasingly dangerous. Paradoxically, even though rescue must come from within, it often cannot, as long as the abuse continues. As Anne described, within that situation, the victim's sense of normality is so distorted, her self-esteem is so eroded, and her need to appease is so enormous that she is often incapable of changing her situation or even thinking about it. In fact, as long as she can deny that she is being abused, she is in her own mind not a victim, but a wife, loved and valued, and her world seems safer. For instance, an abused wife can always find someone in a worse situation. If he ever did that, she'll say, I'd leave. That line, however, changes, and the violence often escalates or changes character to fit the situation. Awaiting the crucial incident that makes that can be very unnerving. I better understood the need for intervention from an occurrence last November. By that time, Janine knew that her husband had a personality disorder that was not curable or susceptible to therapy. They had two boys, ages 2 and 10 months, who were precocious and lively, but very prone in winter to colds and ear infections. Almost daily, she endured verbal and psychological abuse and irrational conversations, and at that point, fairly explosive incidents involving damage or sometimes physical abuse occurred every few days. Despite that, both she and her husband were active in their ward and outwardly appeared to be a fairly typical family. On this November Sunday, she had told her bishop in confidence that her marriage as it was could not continue. If it didn't improve, she would have to leave it. He had not truly understood her situation, she felt, but, as other patriarchs would later do, he had left the door open for her to leave, and that panicked her. When Janine called me as soon as she got home, I unknowingly took the call in the kitchen. Around the wall in the living room sat one of the investigators of the Hoffman case, who had come up to have me sign some copies of Salamander and had stayed to visit. Janine's call was not one that I could postpone or abbreviate to less than 45 minutes. She was too distraught. When I returned to the living room, I knew that the investigator couldn't have missed overhearing my side of the conversation, but politely he continued talking with my husband, John. When I briefly filled him in, he responded not only as a cop, but as a person. His sister, he said, had been in a similar situation, and he understood not only our fears for Janine and her babies, but our worries about my parents, who lived only a few doors from Janine and caught much of the pressure and pain in both practical and emotional ways. He had gone to his sister's house one day, he said, and picked up her and her children and took them home, telling her she could return in a week if she wanted to. It's almost a captive situation, he told me. They literally can't think straight until they get out of it and notice how nice it is to be treated well. They're too busy pleasing the captor. At the time, I noted that his method was probably easier for a 6-foot-something cop than it would be for me. But his reasoning stayed with me. For some time, in fact, my mother and I had been discussing various ways to at least give the marriage a temporary recess or cooling-off period, but I had never been able to convince Janine to leave, even if she felt endangered for more than an hour or two. The next morning, Janine called very early, but I could barely hear her. On Sunday, she had been coming down with the children's virus. Then her husband had kept her up, as usual, arguing, entreating, anything to keep her engaged. And once he went to sleep, well after midnight, the baby began waking up sick. Now she was sick, too, exhausted and demoralized. I drove down, and my mother and I cheerfully packed the three of them into my car, agreeing that she could rest at our house while I tended the babies until she needed to go home and cook dinner. Just in case, we brought enough to see them all through a day or two. As it turned out, they stayed from Monday through Friday, went home for a couple of days, relapsed, and returned for another 4 days. Even though Janine was very ill most of the time, her stay changed her thinking. She did like being treated well. To her surprise, she didn't miss her husband. Though her babies acted out their accumulated stress, they didn't cry for their father or home. In fact, the two-year-old began checking when we went in the car to be sure we would return to our house, not his. During November and December, these periodic timeouts were ostensibly due to illness, and so they invited no hard feelings or punishment at home. Thus far, then, these are the things that had helped. Number one, naming. Janine began talking when her husband was diagnosed as depressed, a legitimate illness that can be treated. The second diagnosis of a personality disorder came later, but devastating as that was, at least it brought some context to the chaos. Number two, defining abuse. Learning that name-calling, ridicule, derision, and cursing out people is not okay or typical. Preventing sleep or medical treatment, reckless driving, denying physical freedom to leave the house or use the telephone is not okay. Physical force, whether it leaves visible marks or not, is not okay. Threatening violence or kidnapping is not okay. The church, I believe, and Janine believes, could significantly improve its efforts to combat abuse by spelling this out in Relief Society, priesthood meetings, bishops' interviews, wherever else is appropriate. My brother-in-law, like many other returned missionaries and priesthood holders, listened to lessons and questions and always gave the right answers and never associated his behavior with the discussion. Number three, breaking down myths. Before she began talking, Janine felt increasingly alienated from the family and we from her because she was living in a split reality we did not comprehend. Secretly, she felt like a complete failure in an otherwise golden family. She was the sixth child to marry in the temple, and possibly the most devout in commitment to church and family above all else. Her marital problems often seemed insurmountable, but she did not see divorce as a possible solution. Not only did I remind her of her talents and accomplishments and potential and assure her that she was handling a very difficult situation better than I or our mother or our sisters could, but I also discussed the problems the rest of us have, which seldom come up at family birthday parties. Very gradually, she began to believe that not only were her children worth saving from misery, but so was she. Gradually, she began to believe that the people she loved and respected would understand and support her if they only knew her true situation. This is the part that still hurts the most, to realize that she didn't know that, that she really felt that alone and that despairing. And I think still there is a justification that is Mormon and is cultural, that what she did in leaving the marriage was okay because it was to save the children. It's just as okay because it was to save her. And I tried not to push her buttons on saving the children too often because I really was trying to get her to believe that her life was as valuable as the children. She had once been a child, unborn and born, and she mattered. And that is an unbelievably difficult thing to convince a woman, I think a Mormon woman, and a woman in that situation to believe. Number four, breaking down isolation. Our family owes Oprah Winfrey a real debt of gratitude. Her program became an unexpected source of reality counseling for Janine as she immersed herself vicariously in discussions of abuse, divorce, child support, custody, and myriad other topics. I had told her that her sisters were legion, but she didn't believe me because other women were doing as well as she was in protecting their secret. Five, paying attention to dreams. Though I am no clinician, journalism had taken me to dream reading too. And over the years, understanding my own dreams, especially recurring ones, had sometimes changed my life. As the family heretic, I introduced this idea rather tentatively, but she grasped it easily as we experimented with interpretations of her most vivid dreams, which were really something, until something made sense and stuck. During those dark months of ambivalence, fear, and torment, it helped me to know that she was dreaming of rooms in her house that weren't physically there, that she had discovered in the dream that were comfortable and luxurious and beautiful. I felt even better when her dreams began to show her taking charge of terrifying situations or emerging whole from trauma. Her dreams were revelatory of her true feelings. When she understood them, they validated her in a very personal way. By Christmas, however, our family was stressed. Janine's family was not getting enough help and intervention from approximately biweekly counseling sessions, and nothing else was immediately available. Although a Christmas truce was called, the volatile situation exploded again right after New Year's, the night that a community support group was supposed to begin but didn't, and Janine and her babies returned again for time out without being sick. With Janine's blessing, I had begun sharing her situation with other siblings, which freed her and them to talk more directly. I know there are families who chew over everything with everyone. Ours isn't one of them. My mother is the repository of all family secrets, and we sometimes talk one-on-one, but we don't talk very much about problems and difficulties, especially if they're private things within our own individual families. And I think that that tends to occur in the majority of Mormon families. Breaking down that silence became an important thing. I knew how vitally Janine needed the support of her sister, her other sisters, but also I knew that she needed support from our brothers and brothers-in-law and her father. It was difficult for the men in our family to understand, A, why her husband didn't shape up, he couldn't, or ship out, he wouldn't. In fact, he didn't see that many problems, other than the fact that he felt Janine kept overreacting. Or B, why Janine hadn't left long ago. They really had to picture living with a roommate half again their size, very strong, whom they loved but who constantly tore them down and yet depended on them. They had to picture being pregnant or nursing the entire span of that marriage or trying to flee with two heavy babies in tow. We all had to imagine how paralyzing physical fear is, even if it's suppressed. How immobilizing is the great unknown, especially when one feels inadequate and afraid. No one else was prepared to take in Janine and her babies at a moment's notice, but they were there in other ways. We also began to rely on trusted friends to give us emotional support. In addition, my occasional contact with police officers and investigators provided a touchstone with reality, for I found that denial is a very strong survival technique and a dangerous one. A person in a demeaning and dangerous situation can survive only by denying the extent of that danger and suppressing many of the emotions that go along with it. My mother was next to Janine in proximity most of the time, and thus rode Janine's family's ups and downs with about half the same ambivalence. And even though my contact was limited to frequent and long telephone conversations and periodic house guests, there were times when I simply could not live with a constant awareness of that precarious situation and turned it off mentally. Every time the telephone rang, we all jumped. We began to expect crisis every other day as the situation worsened. What helped? Number one, broadening the support system for ourselves so we could go on helping. Number two, Janine's continued efforts to seek help, resulting in an inpatient program that hospitalized her husband for 5 weeks. During that time, Janine did not leave, which would have been easy, but worked through many internal issues and prepared to give the marriage every possible chance when her husband returned. Number three, calling in the troops. 2 weeks after they were reunited, an incident involving a tussle with police officers brought the situation to a head, and thankfully without tragedy or anything worse. At midnight, Janine and her babies returned to our home for a final time out. Knowing she could not leave the marriage with her husband's knowledge, she obtained an attorney and an apartment, legal advice, and a protection order, attended their last community workshop on abuse with him, arranged for medical intervention, and went into hiding for 2 weeks until she could move back home. During that period, the strategic support group we had been building proved invaluable. We were very lucky. For one thing, Janine had a college degree, and she had a lot of supportive people around her. I think also the fact that I think my denial was less than it might have been just because of having been a journalist and knowing that terrible things don't always happen to someone else. Now the battle is in court instead of at home, and that's much better. Janine's coping with all the stresses of single parenting, which are considerable, but she also has a job. She's working full-time. To her surprise, she's very happy and very successful. 1.5 and 3 are enrolled in the child care program that they enjoy. The rest of us sleep better, and I'm no longer haunted by visions of a newspaper article reporting a tragic incident of family violence, including from the quotations from the neighbors about this typical young family, a sweet, quiet wife, two cute little boys, and a husband who, though a loner, was such a kind, helpful guy. Thank you for your attention.
It's truly terrifying to be called an expert. I actually didn't ever think of myself that way until I came to BYU 5 years ago. And I realized that I had been hired because of my interest in the research I was doing in family violence. And the first thing, of course, people told me was, but of course you won't be able to say anything about it. Well, they were wrong. Actually, BYU has sponsored and supported my research tremendously. And I say that with a great deal of concern, because if it was unpleasant to talk about abuse generally, it was truly going to be unpleasant to talk about incest particularly. And so they actually paid for the research that was done on the incest perpetrator, the family member no one wants to treat. And I feel very good about that. I suppose the question that I'm asked the most often is, do we really have that much of a problem here in Utah? Well, I thought I'd ask myself that, and I thought I'd look at it. People call me a lot from different places, and they'll say things like, Sister Horton. I say, yes. Are you the lady who's going to save Mormon women from being abused? Well, that seemed like a real tall order. I don't know that I can do it. I know one time I brought home a report card that was not very nice. And my father, who was not sexist, looked at it and he said, what do you think of this? I said, well, I said, it could be better. He said, you're supposed to be making a difference, and so far you haven't done much in that direction. So I've really thought a lot about this, and after I worked on it, I thought, what are people really saying about abuse and religion? What do we really know about it? A lot of people are very outspoken about it. In the Feminist Connection in 1980, they said, the battered usually religious, a threefold problem. First, most religions teach that marriage, if not actually made in heaven, should last, and divorce, even if allowed, is a disgrace. Second, the religious battered woman has read the Bible and knows very well its opinion of women. Her low regard for herself is buttressed by her religion. Third, she has been praying when she should have been acting. Surely she thinks her God will help her if she prays hard enough and long enough. The religious battered woman must come to see reality, that religion has been part of her problem, and the true mental and emotional health can come only when she can reject her religious dependency sufficiently to recognize the fact that the degradation of women is the cornerstone of most religion. Well, that was a heavy thing to think about for me. And as I began to think about what I wanted to do my research in, I thought, let's look at abuse and religion. Let's find out if it's really true that we do have problems here in Utah. So I did an interesting study, at least I thought it was interesting at the time. We hear a lot of awareness things. I really want to thank Ann and Linda for their stories and what they've had to say. We need a great deal more in the way of education. But one thing we don't know is how to treat abuse. In the book that Mildred Pagelow wrote on family violence, it's 700 and some pages. There are only 51 pages on treatment. So we know a lot about defining it now. And what do we do about it? One thing that occurred to me in working with battered women as a counselor, they want to stay in the relationship. They want to end abuse. And there's something else they want. They want to be happy. So I thought to myself, we're going at this wrong. I'm going to go to Utah. And when you do research in Utah, those of you who are into academic things know that Utah is not a normal sample. It just is not a normal sample for most anything. So I thought, well, what do we have here that's going to really help us? Well, here are a lot of people committed to families. We have large families. What I decided to do was look at the women who had ended abuse and had kept their marriages and hopefully were happy and find out what they did. So that was what I did. I put an ad in. First, we started in Utah County and Salt Lake, and then we did a national study. All of the women had to have been in an abusive relationship, which measured in the severe abuse category, according to the conflict tactics scale. They had to have ended it for at least a year. Now, a year didn't really mean anything, except it was an arbitrary time that we felt was most significant. People tend to go back and forth more within a year. If they had stayed apart a year, we felt it was would be fairly significant. So I just asked them how they did it. I thought, and then I asked them, of course, what they did. Well, my hope was that I would have a lot of people writing me, answering these questionnaires across the country, telling me how they'd ended the abuse. Because that's really what your clients and people that talk to you, your friends, want to know, is how to make it stop. Well, the other part, this is what we were looking at, is how did they stop it. The other part is how they're religious or not. Most studies either measure religion based on what denomination you are in, how often you attend church. We did it on several measures, but one of the main ones was, how important is religion in your life? Now, you can ask people a lot of things, and it's interesting when it comes to values. Wealth, travel, things like that on a scale of 1 to 10, you're going to have 4s and 5s. When you ask people how important religion is, it was very interesting because it was usually a 1 or a 2 as very, very important, or a 9 or a 10. And this was essentially, the instrument was a little more complicated than that, but basically what we were looking at were those people who decided for themselves that religion was a real important part in their life. And I'll include some of the Utah statistics for your interest, I think, because they're, of course, more immediate here. But in looking at them, what percent do you think stayed in their marriage, ended the abuse, and were happy? Half? 25%? All right. 15% were still with their partner. And that was how we measured it, not by whether they were still married, if they were still living together, and if the abuse had ended. 15%. And of those, less than 9% rated themselves as satisfied. So, in looking at that, I'll tell you a little bit more about them. But from this, we gained quite a bit of information about how religion fitted in as being important to them. Basically, the women were older. In most of your shelter studies, the women are going to be younger. But these people stayed in these relationships for an average of 8 years. This is for the total sample of those that left. Now, that's longer than most people stay. The national average is not that high. So people are staying in abusive relationships longer than they're staying in normal relationships. Now, I don't know, you can make of that what you will. But these were older people. They were not uneducated. The average education was 13.6 years. And the religious women, interestingly enough, had an average of 14 years of education. In Utah, it came down to 13.5. Also, most of the women were employed. 64% of them were employed, and we only had 11% on AFDC. So there were quite a few that stayed together. Half of them in, well, let me back up. 45% of the women overall had been abused as children. In Utah, 54% of the spouses had been abused as children. Interestingly, too, 26% of these women had been abused before they married their husband by their partner. So for a lot of people, you actually do have some warning. If you're dating someone that's hitting you, they probably are not going to change after you marry them. They stayed an average of over 10 years in these relationships. And they tried a number of ways to end the abuse. I think that when it comes to the use of resources, that it was particularly interesting that though reportedly more closed and isolated, religious victims overall were just as likely to tell someone else about their abuse as non-religious women. They would go to family and friends. They tried many, many avenues. They used more resources than non-religious women, probably reflecting the fact that religion had an important part in making their decision to stay. Now, one thing that, of course, was interesting, and the reason that we named the book what we did, Abuse and Religion When Praying Isn't Enough, out of the entire sample, including religious and non-religious victims, 97% of them tried praying. And none of them referred to that as their primary way of ending abuse in the relationship. So they were really very action-oriented. The religious women left marriages too as a popular way of ending it. The way most people ended it was by divorce. I guess that as I look at it, for those of us in the LDS Church, there are critical questions presented to us by the reality of domestic abuse. Is maintaining the family unit more sacred than the well-being and safety of the individuals within it? Is there any spiritual reason for suffering or abuse to be endured which is perpetrated by one member of the family against another? Who is responsible for breaking up the family? And this is a question that has come up here before. The one who leaves home, or the parent who leaves the parent or partner to escape the abuse, or the one who is being abusive? These questions trouble the minds of battered women and children every day. Therefore, in the church, we have extra things that we have to consider. All victims lose companionship, partners, certain roles as wife and mother when they leave an abusive relationship. There is also, for the religious victim, the idea that they are going to lose eternal consequences as well, and that there's going to be sanction or lack of sanction and support from their own religious community. Therefore, when we enter marriage covenants which promise love, commitment, faithfulness, and have Heavenly Father as a partner, we enter marriage with a covenant with the Lord. Now, I'd bring to your attention a very important point. When is a covenant broken? And when a covenant is broken, who names the fact? Is it the covenant breaker, the one who has ignored, forgotten, transgressed the promises made? Or is it the one who is still living by the promises, the one who is attempting to keep the covenant? Again and again throughout the scriptures, it is God, or one called by God, prophets like Jeremiah, Isaiah, and John the Baptist, who called attention to the fact that the covenant had been broken. When covenants are broken, the person who is keeping them has a right to only keep them as long as they are indeed in force. A woman that I don't even know called me from California. And she precisely called me because she didn't know me, and she wanted some advice. And she asked if I thought her abusive husband should be allowed to enter into the state presidency. Now, I believe the victim was serious in her concern, but her desire was still for secrecy above safety. Now, the victim remains the gatekeeper to safety and change. The church does not condone abuse, but it cannot save a victim from herself. The biggest problems we still have are denial, secrecy, and misuse of the patriarchy. In response to this, I attempted to put together a book that would answer a lot of questions, not to people that did not care about abuse, but who had not been trained about abuse. And so the book was really put together in an effort, as I talked more and more to different groups about violence and families, what you can do, what you need to know. It was written for religious leaders, not LDS leaders per se, but for leaders everywhere in religion, where they are called upon. Pastors, ministers, rabbis, our church leaders are the counselors of choice for the majority of people about abuse. More people will seek help from those religious leaders than from any other one source. Now, not all of them are very pleased with what they get when they seek the resources that they do. But in the book, what we did was divide it up so that the first section truly is guidelines from experts. It tells exactly what abuse in the American family, Dr. Pagelow. Lenore Walker wrote the chapter on spouse abuse. Experts, not me, wrote the majority of these chapters. The second part was on treatment. What could religious leaders, friends, people who are concerned and caring do to help these families? And then finally, we look at some of the cultural issues and the guidelines from religious leaders. The guidelines from religious leaders were not written by LDS authors. Marie Fortune wrote one of the chapters. They are written by different developing religious and secular partnership. And Marie Fortune wrote a very lovely article called Forgiveness, the Last Step. We think of forgiveness as being something in a religious community that you do first. When someone has beaten you, it's not like just a little sandbox quarrel where you just go in and say you're sorry. Forgiveness is a process just like repentance is a process and takes time. So one thing we tried to do was develop some guidelines that would be helpful to leaders in our area and everywhere that might be kind of, again, another laundry list for care. The first thing is to reorder your priorities. The first thing that we must think about when we're dealing with abuse is safety. Safety supersedes relationship needs, which is the number two consideration. And finally, we consider mourning as an important part of an abusive situation. Those are things that religious leaders can help victims with very well. But very often we tend to get the togetherness issues first and the safety issues second. Next, I think it's important to listen to the victim. It is very, very hard for victims to tell you. It's hard for them to come forward. They may only do it once. It's very risky. And if they aren't heard, then they may keep silent for years. Again, there are steps to repentance. And I want to leave you with personal guidelines that I hope will serve you well in your own lives. Abuse like speeding is a choice, perhaps almost an unconscious one, that each person makes in their own life. Yet all I have said up until now is geared toward making it a conscious one for you. All we want you to do is to really begin to think about how important is abuse in your own life. We have to start with ourselves. A number of years ago, I did that with my family. We decided we would stop abuse at home. Now, I was alone at that time, and I had seven children, and some of them were teenagers. And we sat down and we decided there would be no more physical abuse of any kind. Now, what does that mean? That means you don't throw your car keys at your sister when she asks for them. It means you don't throw your hairbrush. It means you don't knock somebody over on the way to the phone. It means you don't shove somebody on the way to the bathroom. It means a lot of things that many of you don't think of as abuse or violence at all. But they are. They hurt and they are damaging. We need to ask the victim to define what's violence. If you've ever talked to your children, he hurt me. Oh, I did not. Talk to the person who was hurt. They're the ones who can tell you whether it hurt or not. So we decided we would not have any more abuse. I'm seeing my daughter off this afternoon to Rick's College. She's my baby. We have not, since that day, had any more physical abuse in the family. And I've had my share of mouthy teenagers, verbal abuse going this way. And I know that if you can make it something that you're really conscious of, that's part of you, part of your own personal crusade, that if you don't touch anyone else's life, you may make a real difference at home for yourself. So make that choice. Make it in your family. And I can guarantee it will make a real difference. My children are very, very much against hitting. And they talk about it as experts themselves. They're much more expert at it than I am. Hitting, slapping, spanking are all forms of violence. You're teaching your children to solve problems by coercion and force. If you do not have children, and I think this is particularly important here in this community, examine yourself and your motives and your resources in selecting to have children. Unwanted children are one of our highest risk groups as being abuse victims. Though unwanted is a counterculture term here when it comes to children, love is not enough to offset poor preparation and changing times or a lack of desire to have a child. Every child should be wanted, and every child that isn't has a strike against them. Encourage your family members and the young people to strengthen themselves in preparation. Education means empowerment. We are not going to change with new laws. We're not going to change by making one or two small policy alterations. We're going to change when everyone is educated. Education is our best tool, and it's up to you to be part of that education. Keep yourself physically and mentally well. This is important, too. You're going to be at your best. You're going to be less likely to be abusive if you do that. And make that personal decision not to ever hit anyone yourself, to help educate them so that they do have a safe home and a safe life. Let's gather toward having new parenting skills replace the slapping and smacking that were allowed before. 10 years ago, if someone asked me if spanking their child was abuse, I would have said no. Today, I would really think about it and discuss it much more carefully. Every time someone is hit, there's a potential that they may be very, very deeply damaged. Whenever you go to the emergency room, no one ever planned to hit the person that hard or hurt them that badly. 7, finally, reach out early for professional help. If you or someone you know needs help, abuse is not something that you can treat directly unless you're trained to do so. Religious leaders have not been trained to do it. Neither have most counselors. Very few people are specifically trained in this particular area. So if you need help, seek out someone who really understands abuse, because the dynamics, especially between physical, sexual, verbal abuse, there's some real differences there. When anyone hits, everyone hurts, and you have a lot more to lose than control when you hit someone. I know that the gospel is true, and that we can have a long time with our families if we build eternal now. And that begins with taking care of our children in a way that we were meant to do. That means taking care of your spouse in a kind and loving fashion. I have brought with me a number of handouts for some of you who are real interested in specifics. I didn't bring this many. I was supposed to catch up and maybe touch on things, and I brought some on what you can specifically do in more detail, and I will leave them up in front so that you may, if you have family members or you have an interest or that's something you're preparing yourself on, you may pick one of those up. Thank you.
We have time for just a few questions. Dr. Horton, as she said, has taken her daughter to Rick's. Her daughter's waiting in the car. If you have questions for Dr. Horton, let's ask those first. And I have a question for you. How large was your national sample and how large was your Utah sample?
We sent out over 1,000 questionnaires. When we finished, there were only 387 victims that actually met on all qualifications. But that was part of the national study. The Utah sample was of only 80.
Okay.
Yeah,
how did you identify your victims?
We put the ads in the paper, and we asked them to identify themselves. And then we, of course, the questionnaire is quite lengthy. But that was what we said. We're interested in knowing what you did to end abuse in your family. If you have been abused and the abuse has been ended for at least a year, write us and let us know, and we will contact you with a questionnaire. Then we set it up with the shelters in these key cities to do that.
Okay. I'm going to repeat that for the tape. How prevalent is physical abuse in Mormon families? Do we have that data?
It's really compared to what is the problem. We really run into problems. Do we have as much abuse? One thing I can show you a number on is how many of these women were abused themselves. All right? We have 54% in the national sample as opposed to 45%.
You said that was the opposite when you gave the... Wasn't it a higher number in the Mormon in the Utah sample?
That's what I said. I'm sorry, did I just say
it? Yeah, you just reversed 45% it.
45% was national. The Utah sample was 54.
54 of the people that responded.
So I could say, well, that seems to indicate. We did a study of children discipline habits in Utah. We did a sample of those. We had, when we asked who spanked their children, for instance, 82% of the people in the national sample responded that they, according to Strauss's scale, that they did spank their children. In the Utah sample, we had 92%. So obviously, we do have a respect for discipline, restraint, but the flip side of that is also when discipline becomes abuse.
Okay, that question, that one, and then that one. You're that one. That was part of our definition, verbal, psychological, physical.
The reason that is really more a technical one than anything else. It's very hard for us to get a good definition. And so it isn't that anybody's denying. I've never seen anyone that was physically abused that was not also emotionally abused. But as far as measuring verbal abuse, psychological abuse, we don't have a very good scale for doing that. It doesn't mean that it isn't more prevalent. It's just that we haven't measured it that way.
Let me just restate that question. What can you say about abuse by mothers on their children? And he gives us the caveat of they probably suffered abuse from the husband.
Okay. I'm not real positive. Do you want to know how many kids are abused as well as spouses are abused by the same people? We did not measure in our sample whether these women who had been abused were actually being abusive too. We measured a lot of things, but we were measuring, we did not include that. However, women were more likely to leave their husbands if the husband was abusing the children by quite a large margin. There were a lot of statistics like that, but if there was only spouse abuse involved, they were more likely to stay than if there was child abuse also involved, then the chances of them leaving were almost twice as great.
Thank you. I think that there's probably a clear link there that hasn't been researched. The next question? We're going to set up flyers over at the signature book so that it can be ordered.
I have the order forms here in front. It's in its third printing now. It comes out at Lexington Books in Boston, so it is available.
It's hard to get it stocked here, though, so go ask people at bookstores if they will keep it. You had the next question? Why do we want to keep abusive relationships intact? Why do the women in them want to keep them intact?
I think that was why they. You mean why did they stay? Well, because marriage represents a great deal more. The relationship is positive for a lot of abuse victims 95% of the time. We're not talking about people that don't have some other sides to them, and that's what makes it so difficult, because there are things in the relationship. You certainly mentioned the economic needs, companionship, a need of a second parent, the child to have a father or mother. I don't like to get into the usual sexist bias of speaking only of victims as being she and abusers as being he, but
My husband is a 95. He's not my husband, but that guy was a 95% nice guy. I mean, he was a really good friend to lots of people. I mean, we're not talking about criminals. We're talking about really nice guys.
Excuse me, we are talking about criminals.
That's true. Really nice criminals who are very nice guys if you meet them on the street.
Nice guys that have a few criminal tendencies.
Okay.
Did not hear the patriarchal connection.
That's probably a good comment. I wrote the title. We'll go on. No. Well, yes, I think there's a very clear patriarchal connection. We're in an institution that says that men ought to be in charge of the house. Now, obviously, the statement, rule of thumb, the phrase rule of thumb comes from the old common law that says that men could beat their wives as long as a stick was not larger than their thumb. That's the rule of thumb. So we're talking about a tradition thousands of years old that says that men own their wives along with their other important property. And that is a tradition that is very slow to change, that it is not legally okay now. But I have good friends whose husbands abused them, who stood with their bishop and their husband screaming at them. I have one friend. Her bishop and husband screaming there, and the bishop is saying, really, I think, you know, she shouldn't be in this situation. And the husband said, I am the patriarchal head of my family. You have no business interfering. And the bishop said, you're right. That's patriarchy. I mean, that's an abusive situation of patriarchy. And as Anne mentioned, these are not all, I mean, we don't always abuse our patriarchy in that way.
Anne, could I, is this on?
Yes.
I didn't dwell on that, but I knew it would come up in the question and answer period. I think that the patriarchal construct is very important religiously and socially and culturally. And in our situation, I never used feminist terms or feminist theory or identified my thinking as feminist thought in discussing this with my sister or with other members of my family. But it was very clear at times that there was a kind of struggle going on that broke down sometimes on male-female terms, sometimes with counselors, sometimes with church leaders, occasionally within the family, where there was just a split on how things were seen. And most of the time, Janine was very lucky in terms of the responses she got from the church leader she talked with. But on the occasions when they would give her kind of a knee-jerk reaction, like, oh, well, my wife probably thinks that too, or, yeah, my kids say that, but they're okay, you know, that kind of response, it would invalidate her for weeks to come. I mean, it just would completely pull the rug out from under her. And sometimes she would also get that kind of a response from a male counselor. And there were a couple of occasions when I would witness my mother and sisters talking in very feminist terms, which, of course, I tactfully did not identify, about how, you know, the women were understanding, you know, the men aren't understanding, the women are understanding, they're helping us out. And ultimately, she did get a lot of support from male members of the family, but that patriarchal tension was present all the way through, and it was important, especially because Janine really believed in it. She really did see herself as a daughter who wanted to please her own father, her heavenly father, her husband, her covenants that she had made were extremely important to her. She felt that she was damning them all to hell if she left the marriage. And even though she knew that he had broken the covenants, that was still so binding for her that it was difficult for her to work through that. And however, once she got past that, she was out. You know, she was free because the intimacy had never fully existed within the marriage. It was mostly the construct.
And I think the construct of patriarchy is always exploitable by men. I mean, so in my experience, it has not been exploited that many times, but there's always that possibility, and that is the danger, I think.
It doesn't always end it, and it doesn't always end the fear. And one thing that I have really come to appreciate is the progress that's been made in terms of law. Because, you know, we're all friends, and we all like each other, and we all assume that we're all equal most of the time, right? And it's only when you get into a really dangerous situation, if you don't have laws saying you can't do this to anyone, even your own wife, you're in real trouble. And when Janine went in and got her protection order, the judge told her, this is just a piece of paper, which she knew. She knew full well. That's why we'd taken all the precautions that we had. And ultimately, you know, everything worked and everybody was safe and so far is safe, we hope that that will continue. But much of the battle in court is to perpetuate that safety, particularly where their children are concerned. And so it doesn't end. And I think that was the hardest thing for me, that I knew that, you know, that I know about those stories. There were several of them that happened during this period of time. If you think back of the people who were, you know, shot outside the front door or crossing the lawn or whatever, those things happen, and they happen in multiple, all kinds of horrible situations involving mothers and children and fathers and mothers and children and fathers and children and all of that. And I was not able to totally deny the possibility, and that made the urgency of the situation very real for me. But I think that it also helped to ultimately protect the family.
I would just like...
Well, we took precautions there, too. What we did was that when Janine's phone calls became a priority in our home and our children began to realize that her needs were sometimes coming ahead of theirs, at least for the moment, we began sharing information. And not to violate privacy or confidentiality, but because to the degree that their lives were infringed upon, they had a right to know. We were careful. The night that the police, well, one night that the police intervened, the final occasion in the marriage, I told Janine that she could come up, but to leave word that she was not coming up, that she was going to the shelter. And the day that we moved her out, we took precautions too, because she and her children had been staying with us all week. Now, as it turned out, that was all, you know, more than we needed to do. But we didn't know that until everybody was safe and everything was taken care of.
I also want to say that it isn't necessarily always that kind of danger. That my husband was an authoritarian sort of guy, and he respects authority. So he thought that the restraining order was a way of me escalating the argument, but I got it because I thought he would respect the judge, and he would respect the fact, and I thought maybe that it would make him understand that it wasn't okay to do that. But I think his sense about